Today we'll begin with the premise, the left should not support Joe Biden. And if the first article doesn't adequately express why we shouldn't vote for Biden, the second article will. The first article is called Why the Left Shouldn't Support Joe Biden by Keely Mullen. The second is called How Liberal Capitalism Has Devolved into Open Tyranny by Rainier Shea. I live in New York City, and almost every conversation I've had about the election in the past month has gone according to the same loop. Trump is awful, Biden isn't much better, but I'll vote for Biden because I hate Trump. I understand this logic. It comes from people's overwhelming desire to resolve the chaos around us and to put an end to the growth of the right. But while this position is very understandable, it is missing the larger picture, which socialists have an obligation to explain. The corporate media and democratic establishment is religiously arguing that returning to normal and fighting the right means casting a vote for the Democrat of the day. Left-wing organizations, socialist organizations, and prominent socialists like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders should not be meekly adopting this logic. Despite how awful Trump is and what his re-election would mean for working people, many millions of Americans are still dreadfully unexcited about voting for Biden. Imagine if, in this situation, rather than conceding when he did and bending the knee to the establishment, Bernie Sanders was campaigning for a new party for working people. In the context of a global pandemic, an uprising against racist police violence, and overwhelming support for Medicare for All and taxing the rich, this could have galvanized millions of young and working people. It would have presented a historic opportunity for a jailbreak from the Democratic Party. Because of his refusal to take these steps, we're now staring at a contest between two bad options for working people with nowhere else to look. Socialists have a responsibility to clarify how we got here and what opportunities have been missed. Debates on the left. In an article written by Eric Blanc and Neil Meyer, prominent figures in Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, they write, "Socialists cannot stop this nightmare on our own. But we can and should be part of the broader movement that does. Yes, unfortunately, that means voting for Joe Biden and doing our best to convince our friends, family, coworkers, comrades, and neighbors to do so as well, and to do so regardless of where you live." This is a departure from what was an already conservative approach taken by a number of leading figures in DSA who signed a pledge calling cleverly for an anti-Trump vote without ever saying Biden's name. DSA is an organization that is close to hitting 80,000 members. It includes elected officials in local and state governments as well as unions. It has an obligation to lead the struggle against the far right, not abdicate it because there's an election afoot. There are millions of people who are tired of being taken for granted by the Democratic Party and are ready for bold, left-wing leadership. To these people, Blanc and Meyer's advice is, organizing on behalf of Joe Biden is the most effective way to fight the right. This is a tragic abdication. There are already hundreds of millions of dollars flooding into Biden's campaign, thousands of NGOs doing GOTV, and figures like Obama and even Bernie running around the country getting out the vote for Biden. Yet somehow it's also the responsibility of disillusioned working people who've been thrown out with the garbage by the Democratic Party to get out the vote for Biden? Hundreds of thousands of working-class fighters could be brought into the socialist movement if they saw something bold and unapologetic on offer. However, what they're seeing from certain leading members in DSA, as well as from Bernie Sanders himself, is more of the same. We hope rank-and-file DSA members will respectfully discard Blanc and Meyer's advice and instead call for a vote for Howie Hawkins, the Socialist Green Party candidate, as a means of concretely pointing to the Democratic Party exit sign. While we don't agree with everything he says, DSA member Jeremy Gong's response to Blanc and Meyer's article is overall very positive, and we would encourage DSA members to read it. We would enthusiastically welcome DSA chapters to join Socialist Alternative in our efforts to pull together coalitions in our cities to prepare mass demonstrations and civil disobedience if Trump tries to steal the election. If Trump wins, it will not be the fault of working people who didn't feel represented by either candidate and chose not to vote. It will also not be the fault of people who registered a protest vote against both candidates. It will be the fault of the Democratic Party for putting up a corporate, sometimes catatonic, candidate to fight Trump when they had Sanders on offer, a candidate that was galvanizing millions of people. The Democratic elite created Trump. In their article, Blanc and Meyer do not devote a single sentence to explaining the role the Democratic Party played in creating the space for Trump and Trumpism to thrive. This is likely not an accident, as any thorough investigation into the logic of widespread lesser evilism would turn up proof that the Democrats' ruthless attacks on working people over decades has fertilized the soil for Trumps to pop up. This is a crucial historic lesson for working class activists to draw out. On November 8, 2016, there was a collective jaw drop as Trump overtook Hillary Clinton in electoral votes and became the U.S. president-elect. The liberal pollsters and pundits stared in shock, completely unable to explain how their perfect candidate with decades of experience in D.C. lost to a bombastic billionaire businessman and reality TV star. They couldn't understand the ascendancy of Donald Trump, just like the ascendancy of the Tea Party before him, lay at the feet of their own incompetence and subservience to the billionaire class. The Democrats controlled the White House and both branches of Congress during then the worst financial crisis in the U.S. since the Great Depression, until now. With their supermajority, they found it in their hearts to give trillions of dollars to big banks on Wall Street, but shrugged in the face of 9 million jobs lost and 4 million homes foreclosed on. In the 8 years that followed, while Obama and Biden were comfortably in office, billionaire wealth exploded and the working and middle classes never got off their knees. Sure, unemployment fell, but the vast majority of jobs created under Obama's administration were low-wage service jobs. Those same jobs that have now disappeared amidst the 2020 COVID-19 hellscape. The Democrats' predictable abandonment of working people during the Obama-Biden administration, which followed the reckless lending, deregulation, and financialization efforts and the relentless attacks on the gains of working people that marked the Clinton and Bush presidencies, laid the basis for Trump's surprise victory in 2016. They were not able to motivate working-class people to get out and cast a vote for Hillary Clinton, whose presidency would give them more of the same. More than 200 counties that supported Obama in 2012 flipped for Trump just 4 years later. Trump also whipped up a nativist, reactionary agenda in his 2016 campaign, which he has built on ever since. The Democrats were in no position to mount a credible challenge to his reactionary ideas. So not only did the Democrats lay out a red carpet from Trump's Manhattan penthouse directly to the steps of the White House, they've done a grand total of nothing to fight him during the 4 years he's been there. They've poured literally years' worth of attention and energy into the Russiagate scandal and impeachment nonsense, effectively removing themselves from the real fights that affect working people. They've substituted any real fight against Trump for symbolic acts of resistance and sassy tweets. This is made depressingly clear with Amy Coney Barrett's seamless nomination to the Supreme Court, which the Democrats did not even pretend to fight. If the left is ever going to gain the ear and attention of ordinary people, it cannot be done by lining up behind whatever corpse the Democratic Party trots out on election year. That is not true harm reduction. That approach contributes to the steady march towards something worse than Trump by propping up the exact forces that handed him the mic in the first place. A Biden administration may be prepared to spend a significant amount of money given the scale of the ongoing economic crisis, but we should be under no illusion he will represent any semblance of a progressive agenda. His administration, as well as most Democrats in Congress, will relentlessly attack working people with big business bailouts, handouts to big insurance companies, and opposition to popular policies like Medicare for All. The space for the far right will very likely grow under a Biden administration, and Trump may well continue building support for his ideas even if he loses. In fact, a Trump unleashed situation where he is free to rally his base outside the confines of elected office could lead to the creation of a far right party. A real fight against Trump and the reactionary forces floating in his orbit requires decisive steps. We need the broader left to boldly take up campaigning for Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, COVID relief for working people, and to defund the police. As part of building these movements, it is crucial that we begin taking steps to build an independent, left-wing political alternative outside the Democratic Party. The real harm reduction that organizations and prominent figures on the left should be engaging in is mobilizing the broadest ranks of the working class into mass movements and urgently creating a new political party with a working class program and class struggle approach. A party that can be a political home to the millions of ordinary people who supported Bernie Sanders. Left-wing organizations and figures should not direct disillusioned working people back into the Democratic Party trap. They should be leading from the front in a march directly outside the Democratic Party and toward something new. There's no time to waste in fighting the right and the billionaire class. How Liberal Capitalism Has Devolved into Open Tyranny, by Rainier Shea. Liberalism, particularly the type of liberalism from after World War II, has advertised itself as the only alternative to chaos and barbarism. As Henry Kissinger said, in order to rationalize helping the side of the liberal geopolitical bloc, in every era, humanity produces demonic individuals and seductive ideas of repression. The task of statesmanship is to prevent their rise to power and sustain an international order capable of deterring them if they do achieve it. The interwar years' toxic mixture of facile pacifism, geopolitical imbalance, and allied disunity allowed these forces a free hand. These words, which come from a man who's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands and for propping up dictatorships like the Pinochet regime, betray their own hypocrisy. Liberalism doesn't necessarily protect human rights, equality, or democracy, and Kissinger knows it. Liberalism's goal is to maintain the capitalist and imperialist power structure, which in recent years has required liberalism to morph ever more into something openly tyrannical and repressive. After the torture, mass surveillance, erosions of civil liberties, and blatant wartime censorship that appeared in the first years following 9/11, the ruling class tried to act like the US-NATO bloc was as free and democratic as ever. But the conditions had changed from the more stable decades of the mid to late 20th century, and the state could only respond by making society less and less free. Due to its reckless invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and its growing rivals Russia and China, Washington was experiencing a decline of its global hegemony. So its wars had to be perpetually continued and expanded, meaning that anyone who sought to expose the atrocities within those wars or counter the lies behind them had to be dealt with. In 2010, when Chelsea Manning used WikiLeaks to expose atrocities that had been committed by U.S. armed forces, the government started a campaign to make an example of her and all other whistleblowers. They convicted her of having published on the internet intelligence belonging to the U.S. government, having knowledge that intelligence published on the internet is accessible to the enemy, even though this was essentially a made-up offense. They put her into solitary confinement for the purpose of trying to get her to implicate others, an act of physical and psychological coercion that constituted torture. In 2013, they sentenced her to 35 years in prison, with Obama only having pardoned her as a way to look good while leaving office. Last year, they jailed her again for refusing to testify in a secretive grand jury, amounting to what the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture calls an open-ended, progressively severe measure of coercion fulfilling all the constitutive elements of torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. This year, Manning tried to kill herself in prison. This war on whistleblowers has allowed Western institutions, with their supposed ideals about protecting liberties and rights, to redefine what these terms mean. In the society that the imperialist governments and their media propagandists have created, it's acceptable for Julian Assange to suffer years of medical neglect and torture through solitary confinement. It's also acceptable for Edward Snowden to be under threat of similar types of torture should the U.S. capture him. No matter how sadistic or extreme the tactics used in this war become, it's all worth it for the cause of national security. With the treatment of Julian Assange in this last year in particular, the fraudulence of the West's ideals have become boldly obvious. As The Intercept's Charles Glass wrote this month, Over the 17 days of Julian Assange's extradition hearing in London, prosecutors succeeded in providing both crimes and conspiracy. The culprit, however, was not Assange. Instead, the lawbreakers and conspirators turned out to be the British and American governments. Witness after witness detailed illegal measures to violate Assange's right to a fair trial, destroy his health, assassinate his character, and imprison him in solitary confinement for the rest of his life. Courtroom evidence exposed illegality on an unprecedented scale by America's and Britain's intelligence, military, police, and judicial agencies to eliminate Assange. So if you haven't figured it out yet, dear listeners and viewers, this is why we should not vote for Joe Biden for U.S. president or for Dogcatcher. When you vote for a lesser evil candidate, you're voting for more of this garbage. How has the ruling class tried to preserve liberalism's facade of legitimacy amid these total breakdowns of civil and human rights protections? The same way they've dealt with the baggage from the 2011 NATO invasion of Libya that's destroyed the country, or the U.S.-created war in Syria, or the 2014 U.S. coup in Ukraine that's given rise to a genocidal neo-Nazi regime, or this last year's Washington-orchestrated Bolivia coup that's resulted in massacres and torture. Conceal the inconvenient facts from the public. In 2013, while the hybrid war on Syria was in full swing and Washington was quietly preparing to carry out a coup in Ukraine, the U.S. government took a large step to expand its information control heading into a new Cold War with Russia. It repealed a ban on the government from covertly spreading propaganda to American citizens, which has since resulted in a noticeable increase of pro-war narratives within the U.S. media. Especially in the wake of the U.S. proxy war in Ukraine, Russia was intensely vilified, and an atmosphere of the neo-McCarthyism started to creep in. I would say it stomped in. Then in 2016, when the election of Trump served as a catalyst for the further weakening of U.S. global influence, the ruling class clamped down, not just through propaganda, but through greatly intensified online censorship. At the end of his term, Obama signed the Countering Foreign Disinformation and Propaganda Act into law, creating a program for controlling information that Lambert Strether of Corrente concludes is undeniably an erosion of press freedom. A careful reading of the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act shows there is good reason to fear an impact on American independent or alternative media. As these numerous small web outlets are non-state actors, the act can be colorably construed to apply to them, and many of the act's functions and funding opportunities impact them. Throughout the last 4 years, there have also been numerous waves of online censorship from Google, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which have acted on behalf of their partners in the U.S. intelligence agencies. They've sabotaged social media accounts from anti-imperialist outlets like Venezuela Analysis, as well as purged accounts from Venezuela, China, and other U.S. rivals for supposedly promoting disinformation. Top neoconservatives have been in on this censorship campaign, and they've often been able to help directly orchestrate it through think tanks like the Atlantic Council. It's all served to make people less likely to notice the human rights abuses, civil liberties violations, dishonest state propaganda, and perpetual warfare that have been carried out by Washington and its proxies during these last several years. As inequality and poverty continue to increase throughout the Western world during the pandemic, and the U.S. empire invests in increased militarism over helping the people, these propaganda and concealment measures serve to keep the population pacified. The ruling class hopes that society will remain detached from the ongoing creep towards tyranny, and that the state has already been fortified enough. So make no mistake, dear viewers and listeners, voting for Biden is voting for this shit, more so than voting for Trump is. Again, I'm not telling you to vote for Trump, but absolutely, I'm telling you, do not vote for Biden. Again, I'm going to tell you that friends don't let friends vote for corporatists, because corporatists prop up tyranny. Income inequality and U.S. hegemony are why we have tyranny. We need to figure out how to vote for something other than neoliberalism.